This is Reverberations, a podcast from New Amsterdam Records. My name is Majel Connery, and in this podcast, I'm guiding a series of conversations with some of New Amsterdam's artists, marking the release of new albums and delving into the creative process. On this episode, I'm interviewing Alex Sop about her record, The Hem and the Haw. Alex may be known to you as a flutist with ensembles like Y Music, The Knights, and Now Ensemble. She's also collaborated with folks like Paul Simon, Nico Muley, Sufjan Stevens, Ben Folds, Philip Glass, The Dirty Projectors, The National, and I'm omitting a lot of names here. Alex is also a singer and a songwriter, and this album puts those things at center. So I'm going to start here with the portion of our conversation where Alex describes how singing came to occupy a more prominent role for her in her professional life.
You know, I first started singing with Y Music kind of out of necessity of us needing someone to do background vocals when we would collaborate with artists. And then that started taking more and more of a role on stage. You know, I was really lucky to be in some insane situations that I would not have found myself in as a vocalist unless I also played the flute, you know, like I do. I would like to tell the story, actually, of the first time that I sang in public as a soloist. And that happened because I used to have these epic, Gabe Kahane, a good friend, Gabriel Kahane, a composer, used to have these kind of epic dinners where he would cook. He's an amazing chef, and would have friends over. And I remember one time I was at his house and we were, you know, eating and drinking wine. And I started singing something as a joke. And he was like, "What the heck is going on?" And he ran to the piano and then we sang some songs and it was really fun. And then a couple weeks later, he called me up and said, "Hey, I'm doing a workshop for a piece that I'm building, and I'd really like it if you could come and play some and also sing." And I was so excited. I can't tell you how I've never been that excited in my life. And so I went and did the workshop, and then it turned into this production, this staged version of The Ambassador. It was really an illuminating experience for me in terms of just how alive I felt using my voice like that, and how the moment that you open your mouth and you're singing and you're delivering lyrics, it's like a different kind of experience in terms of your connection to the performance. And I loved that so much that I kept kind of chasing that with how Y Music started to function, and throwing myself in the mix to sing background vocals with people like Ben Folds, Jose Gonzalez, and then, you know, the craziest thing was singing background vocals with Paul Simon on tour in stadiums. It's been a wild ride. And so the other thing that I think is important to mention is that even though I have this really deep and close relationship with the flute, for some reason, I don't find myself reaching for it when I want to, you know, if someone's like, "Hey, Alex, come up with a line for this part. Can you come up with a harmony?" It's really hard for me to just find that out of thin air on the flute. I have a much easier time connecting to my creative expression with just my voice.
Morning dove, sleeping sound on the wire. That extends from my heart to the fire.
The world on the album. What would you say is the relationship between your voice and your flute playing? Does the flute play a role compositionally for you? I mean, it's obviously a huge presence on the album. It's almost like a recurring character that takes different forms. Mm. Like it sort of launches Bougainvillea, for example.
Yeah.
In this really bold and dramatic and different way, like this sort of layered textural thing.
Yeah.
I love those low flutes. Like, I'm a sucker for recording the really big flutes, so bass flute and alto flute. But again, it's like more of that, just the color of the sound and that texture.
About the album conceptually. So am I right to think that at a base level, there is something for you about duality in this album? In some of your press materials, you're expressing a desire to get one side of yourself in conversation with the other. So I'm guessing that this is kind of thematic for you, but how heavily do you apply that theme?
It is really important to me, and it's something that I feel all the time. I feel like me, the dreaming, sleeping version, and me, the waking version, and me, the version that can't move because of all the things that I want to do, just kind of paralyzing me and locking me down.
And is one of those things trying to get this album into the world?
Absolutely, for sure. It's something that I've known that I've had in me for a long time, but I wanted it to be perfect, which doesn't exist. And, you know, I think a lot of that's kind of born out of a background in classical music, sure, and just my personality of hanging on to things too long and too preciously. And just the desire, I think, you know, getting a little bit older, quite frankly, and just being like, wow, there is really nothing to lose. Like, I am ready to share this other side of me that I've believed in, but maybe didn't believe in enough to fully let out. And now I want to practice what I preach, which is everyone, I believe, has these infinite rivers of creativity within themselves. And it's just a matter of, you know, sure, it's a privilege to have the space to allow to tap into them, but really, you don't know what you're capable of until you sit down regularly and try.
When you do sit down to write, what does your process look like?
It's a combination of a lot of different things. You know, it's a lot of voice memos while waiting for the train, awkwardly whisper singing into my flute. And then a lot of it is sitting down in Logic, honestly, and just it's a miracle that I got through conservatory harmony, because I don't know. I'm not even exaggerating. I don't really understand music theory and harmony, but I know what feels good, and I know how to trust my instincts to find it. And I really just sit down and play chords and notes until they feel right to me, and then kind of mining for sounds and colors. And a lot of the time with this, I knew that the sound choices that I would find electronically would then be replaced by better sounding versions of that from my dear friend and collaborator and producer, Thomas Bartlett. And then a lot of them we ended up keeping because they just were a sound of the song at that point. You know, they're like embarrassing Logic sounds that definitely found their way to the final record, but actually that I'm attached to now.
Let's pick a song, like just for the sake of like it being my favorite song.
Oh, I want to know what it is. I'm so curious.
Well, I like the title track. I think it's really compelling. Also, just as a side note, I think that one of the things on this album that leapt out at me immediately, because somehow it's very unusual, is that it's buoyant. Like this is
buoyant.
A joyful album, and it's like kind of unusual.
Like, yay. I love
really
that.
It really is. It totally leaps off the page. But like, walk me through The Hem and the Haw, the single.
Sure.
Like, tell me as much as you can remember, how far back in the mists of time does this song go and how did it take shape?
This song is actually one of the last songs that I wrote. And I wrote it when I'd already started working on songs with Thomas. I think that's true. And this song, you know, what happens actually a lot of the time is that I write the song and I sing these vocal melodies, but I have no lyrics. And in the process of writing them, I'll kind of stumble upon a vowel sound or a kind of a hold word here or there. And then sometimes I find a way to work that into the song and then that becomes the song. But normally lyrics for me are the last step and something that, wait for it, I hem and haw a lot about. I think that's because I get attached to kind of like the potential of what a lyric can hold. And because I'm attached to this melody that has no words, it becomes an act of torture to find something to express that. I think that's something probably a lot of songwriters deal with. But The Hem and the Haw weirdly kind of revealed itself in full, in real time. I mean, that does not always happen. That only happened with two of the songs on this record, where the lyrics just came and it was easy.
Editing the view, reflecting through a tiny screen, while my self-esteem oscillating. It says, get your water paints, go and translate what you create while you are sleeping.
I started off by making it was like a string pit sample, actually, and it kind of, I put it into a sequencer, and so it gave me kind of the feel, and then I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to replicate this with my puffy bass flutes, and I actually didn't own a bass flute, so I ran and pretended that I wanted to buy a bass flute, and I just borrowed one, and I ended up buying it. Thank you, Flute Center of New York. But at the time, I was just like, I need this paintbrush immediately. And so I replaced those sounds that I'd gotten with my synth on the flute, and that became kind of like the rhythmic body of the song. And the melody really super just spun itself, and I knew the words to the chorus immediately. That it was about the hem and the haw. I knew that it was about wanting to be different and wanting to unstick yourself from this paralysis of potential.
How did the sort of central, musically, it's a sort of melee?
Yes. It's a whistle freak out. I am obsessed with the penny whistle, the tin whistle. I play a lot of traditional music, and I always, much to the irritation of my colleagues, I always have a whistle on my person. And if there's ever like, you know, for example, like if we're playing something in orchestra, this is only when I'm with my people in the nights who I feel really comfortable around. But, you know, like sometimes I'll be like, oh, there's a solo coming up. just for comic relief, I'm going to whip out the whistle. And like everyone's like, oh God, Alex, stop. But so I'm obsessed with the penny whistle. And this that break is basically just three penny whistles, two with delay on them. And it's just me actually like I learned I'm going to go ahead and say I learned this technique from Sufjan Stevens. I used to play with him a while back. And I remember one time we were in his studio doing some Christmas recordings. He has those Christmas albums. And we were both playing whistles and recorder duets. And he was just recording layer on layer. And he had this like insane way of just doing these ornaments. I'm like, Sufjan, what the heck? Like, how are you doing this? And he's like, oh, I just move my fingers as fast as possible, super randomly. And I was like, sick. That is sick. And so I like to think that I learned that kind of ornamental technique from him that I used in this part.
Can we talk about style on the album as a whole?
Sure.
I mean, Alex, I have to say the level of stylistic diversity on this album is so high. I'll give you an example. At one point, I can't remember what song it is, but you begin a song and I was like, this almost sounds like Enya. Yes. And then at another point in the song, I was like, this kind of sounds like Bjork. And then there was like a moment where there was just a sort of arrangement of contemporary classical stuff for like whoever your amazing session players were. And I was like, this is just so stylistically everything that if I were Alex, I would be really hard pressed to say what I am. And I wonder if you experience that as like a problem or a pressure, or if you are learning to just embrace it and be like, yeah, isn't it exciting not to be able to know what you are?
I really believe in that version of the answer. I think it's a huge source of joy for me to actually keep people and myself guessing on that matter. Uh-huh. And I mean, you know, that ties into being a classically trained flute player I love playing Beethoven symphonies. I love playing Philip Glass. I love playing Paul Simon. I love cutting up pieces of paper and making stop motion movies on airplanes. I love making my own music. When I'm doing the thing, it's the thing. And then there's infinite other things that I love to do. And isn't that, I mean, doesn't that just make me so lucky? And if I had to pick one and only do that, I think for my spirit, I would crumble.
I mean, it raises an interesting question for me about folks who have like really hardcore conservatory training in one area and then are self-trained in another area. And I count myself among these people. Mm. My personal view of this is that having gone through a rigorous amount of training in certain areas, you understand how to drill down.
That definitely is my feeling. And, you know, I also think it's really important to keep a sense of play alongside all of that, because I mm-hmm. think that's the version of the conservatory training gone wrong, is where you lose all sense of play and actually just like expressive pleasure seeking in a way. And I think it's really important to develop practices alongside your main practice where you're really not expecting much of yourself other than just to try mm-hmm. something and put something out there. And, you know, I had this club with friends a long time ago, which we called Project Pterodactyl, where we would make ourselves do things as a collective that like the idea of which made us cringe, right? So like we did like poetry reading and like went to African dance class and like just exposing like what an idiot you are at something and how much fun it is to just do something and not expect yourself to know how to do it. Not expecting greatness all the time and not expecting perfection has helped kind of loosen something in me that is maybe my most kind of core belief.
I have one more specific question for you about actually the sensation of orchestral music in one of your tracks. So your closing track is Loon. Mm-hmm. And Loon at a certain point decides to, I don't know, like turn into a vista. Mm-hmm. And there are all these different elements that are doing their own thing in this landscape that is a little bit gently chaotic, but yeah. also just kind of like, I don't know, it actually reminds me of being at this bird sanctuary that I go to a couple times a year. What was your idea there? And compositionally, like, how did that come to be? It's very interesting.
I mean, you pretty much just described it. It's like a zoom out on a natural landscape. And it started off, I made all of those sounds with a combination of my voice and the flutes and all the different flutes kind of chattering and that loon that I had recorded. And then I made on synthesizer these kind of like foghorn parts that were just these stacked chords that kind of moved. And then I sent that to my good friend Mike Atkinson, who's an amazing horn player and dear friend. And I was like, you know, I don't know if it's going to be possible because there's so many voices and they're kind of moving chaotically, because it was just all something that I played totally improvised. And actually, like, I played it once and I was like, okay, that's what it is. And then he took that and so carefully reconstructed it, but with the French horn. And it really takes that part to another level in terms of, you know, I wanted it to be a little bit scary, like a little bit unsettling, but also just so lushly beautiful. I love birds. I mean, I play the flute, you know, like sometimes I'm like, do I love birds because I play the flute? Do I play the flute because I love birds? I don't know.
There's a very stuffy part of my brain that was like, Alex is doing programmatic music here. She is using the sound of the flute to evoke the voices of the Nate, you know, like in some like pastoral, old school Dvorak or Beethoven sort of way. And I was like, well, on one hand, like, how do you not?
If you're exactly. a flutist. Like, not know. I don't know. Not totally know, but it's not... I don't really have like a statement or kind of like an agenda or overall vision. It's really just things that I love.
Alex Sopp's album, The Hem and the Haw, drops on April 19th, and you can find it by searching on Bandcamp. You can also go to newamrecords.com for more information about this album and other recent and upcoming releases. The next episode of Reverberations will be a conversation with Maz Swift about their new album, The 10,000 Things, Praise Songs for the Irreligious. You can find Reverberations wherever you get your podcasts, and if you feel so moved, please follow us and leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. My name is Majel Connery, and I will talk to you again next time.